It's time for Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Mat-Su Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky.
Well, folks, once again, it's time for another edition of Valley Edition. It's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio Terry Snyder. Let's begin, Terry. The initial focus of attention has been on the city of Palmer. And now that we've got a little distance from Tuesday, the real question is, what impact will what happened Tuesday, which is a selection of a person that is familiar to many people in Palmer, Linda Combs, to fill the vacated seat occupied formerly by Brad Hansen. So what do you think that's all going to mean when the next meeting happens and they have a full complement of people up there? How will that change things?
It's going to be very interesting to see how that changes things. She certainly has experience. She's been on there 6 years prior to this. She's up for re-election. There's no real term limits, I guess we should mention, Mike, at this present time for the City of Palmer council seats. Former Councilman Brad Hansen that went to work from the city had set on the council for almost 18 years before making that transition. Combs spent 6 years on there and then again was up for re-election last fall and was not selected by the voters. But in the end, there were only two candidates that the council had to select from. It was not a unanimous vote. It was a 4-2 vote.
Right.
I don't know how that will change things. You know, we've seen this at the Assembly. They had selected Assemblywoman Barbara Doty was selected by the Assembly, and some actually well-known people were rejected at that point from that. But Ms. Doty had unanimous decision from the Assembly. So it'll be interesting to see how they all play together. There are some people, most people on the council that have already worked with Ms. Combs, other than her niece, Sabrina Combs, who, along with Pete LaFrance, had, you know, rejected her as the candidate and were the two that voted against. So I don't know, Mike, you've sat on the council, you've witnessed a lot of these transitions. Should the City of Palmer, that only got two actual candidates to apply, should they have kicked the ball a little farther out to see if they could get a more diverse group that might apply for that seat? I mean, it is sort of a interesting seat because you have to run for re-election just a couple of days, a couple of months after you get elected. So it'll be very interesting. What is your view on it, Mike?
Well, I think the bottom line is four people, a majority necessary, who know Linda Combs very well, chose to vote for her and have her rejoin the council. Mm-hmm. I think even if there had been additional candidates, they would have been hard-pressed to be chosen ahead of Linda. And that's in part because she's a known quantity, she's been there, and she is also going to be able to step right in and probably, without missing a beat, continue on the discussions that happen at the next council meetings. She's very familiar with the process. Mm-hmm. She's very familiar with many of the issues. So I think in some respects, she, to my mind, was the safe choice.
Palmer does like to do the safe thing.
We do. And then the real question to my mind, and this is always interesting when we look at a council or an assembly, school board, whatever, what happens to the way people are up there when an election is about to happen?
That's true.
So what we have now are literally four people on that council, majority of the council, starting with the mayor, who's running in the Republican primary for the House seat.
That's right.
Palmer. We have two of the sitting council members, Pete LaFrance and Richard Bess, whose time is up. They're running.
We don't know because the candidate packages aren't out yet, but it would
presumably
they would.
Right, and that's an important point to make. But should they cast their hats in the ring, we also have Linda Combs, who also possibly would be running to retain that seat. So we would have four people on the council who are in the process of running. My experience about that, and you tell me what you think, is that when you shift into campaign season, people seem to alter. Maybe it's just a matter of thinking more carefully about what they're saying, but they seem to alter their wordings of things and perhaps even some of their votes. What's your sense of that?
Yeah, it definitely kicks it into kumbaya mode, and that's probably good for the city of Palmer that people are giving it a lot more thoughtful process and you aren't shielded by that luxury of not having to go in front of the voters who have voted you in for a couple of years. Palmer does it, we should probably say, Mike, Palmer does it unusual too. You don't really run against anybody. When you run for election, you run for the top vote getters. So there could be as many candidates on the ballot as they get signatures on their petition to run for. But in the end of the day, it's the top two in the case of the ones that Richard Vess and Pete LaFrance would presumably be rerunning for their seats, and the same thing for Linda Combs. So it's done a little differently here. It's going to be a different ballot, too, than we're used to seeing. So, yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see.
So that's true for the two incumbents who presumably were running again. It's the top two win. If you got seven people in there, it's still the top two. In the case of the other seat, though, I detect a slight difference in the sense that Linda Combs will have occupied the seat. If she chooses to run again, then you're running against Linda.
Because you could almost say she's an incumbent, although
right,
she's not
right.
been in this seat.
In other words, even if there are seven people running for that seat,
yeah,
it's to replace Linda Combs in that
seat.
But
it's only a two-year term, as
right.
the other two are for a three-year term.
Yeah.
So lots to think about there. But that said, the packets won't be out until the first week of July. Candidates will have a couple of weeks towards the end of July to get their petition in, which just in list 15 or so names of people that says, yes, these people should run for office. And then the campaigning begins. And this is going to be a very – I was having lunch with somebody in Anchorage yesterday. And, of course, they're trying to fill in an assembly seat, too, that's being vacated by an assembly member that's ill, Tim Steele. They're going to be going to ballot on that. It's going to be a mail-in. Of course, they've kind of got that down to a science now. But what we're getting in the way with, what the borough election gets in the way with, is the primary election that almost every House seat, just about every House seat, is running for election. Some of them are more challenged than the other. Some of them have a pretty clear focus and will probably be reelected. But there are some new faces there, and it takes up a lot of media. There's a lot of mail. Wait for your mailbox to fill up. People are knocking on doors. People are going to be very overwhelmed during the season that will even turn into a higher gear once the primary is over in August, and then people really start going to that November date. So I often worry that these local elections just kind of get lost in the wash. People kind of get concentrating on that November date. And it takes a lot of effort, and it should be applauded on the behalf of the clerk's office, both of the borough and the cities, to get out and let people know, wait a minute, you have a local election that happens before then. And get people to the polls for that.
So this week we had a forum sponsored to look at Democratic candidates in the primary, or the candidates in the primary. Mm. I have to be careful about how we describe these things these days, because things have become more complicated. There are two major candidates running in the Democratic primary to run against U.S. Representative in the House and Congress, Don Young. One is an independent, Galvin,
mm-hmm.
and the other one is a Democrat,
mm-hmm.
Shane.
Mm-hmm.
And they met in a forum for about an hour, talked about why they were running. This was at the Downtown Deli here in downtown Palmer. And they talked about why they were running, but the central message around which both spoke had to do with health care.
Mm, good. Somebody needs to pay attention to it.
It was a major, it was very interesting. And the suggestion is, and we're awaiting perhaps further primary discussions that involve the Republican candidates, but I'm also told that when Galvin and Shane were in Anchorage, fairly robust continuing discussion, well attended. Once again, the issue was prominent, health care, whether it was some form of single payer, et cetera, but a very, very strong position. I'm wondering whether that is emerging as the distinction where Republican candidates are not focused on bringing up the issue, discussing it, wanting any significant changes, while Democratic candidates in general are saying, let's change this?
Well, I think that's been sort of the theme, but it could be argued, too, that it'll be interesting to see what the theme is on the other side of the fence, so to speak. But, you know, that these forums have been playing to the party that has been pushing that, so it would make sense that that would go to the top of their discussion level, because healthcare has been really probably passed down from Bernie Sanders as should be a key issue. It is. It's the highest. We have 34% higher than any other state healthcare costs. And these aren't state jobs that these candidates are running for, but the federal government has a lot to say about that. And it's something that's been kind of kicked down the road a little bit on the federal side. And so it should come, and it is, it's a pain point that people are starting to feel. And that's when they start talking about it, is when their premiums go up, when their deductibles go up, when they get sicker, when it means more to them. And so you would expect it to be. So it'll be interesting to see. There has been some Republican candidate governor forums, I think. And I think,
right,
and I'd be interested to know.
The one in particular in Kodiak that,
right,
that ran 2.5 hours.
Yeah, I would bet resources probably are going to be, and certainly the way that it's shaking out to be, it'll probably be about the permanent fund. And it'll be about, not that they really, it's the federal government, so it doesn't really, but it's also, it's still going to, those governor forums are going to be interesting to see how they contrast.
Well, and it looks as if there are maybe four major candidates playing here.
Mm-hmm.
The Democratic primary has, of course, the entrance of Mark Begich. And I think it's safe to say that anyone, knowing his past performance and so on, would say he's the person to beat in that primary.
He's likely a good campaigner.
He's mm-hmm. likely to be the Democratic candidate for governor. And then, of course, to sum up what's happened over this past week, Governor Walker has said, given that circumstance, while he might have, as an independent, participated, which he can do in the Democratic primary, he's not going to do that. He's just going to run as an independent, as the way he
So did. He'll collect signatures to get on the ballot, the
right.
general ballot.
Right. Right. And then that leaves the Republican primary. And obviously, Michael Donlevy, former state senator, had jumped out to an early lead. If I do a simple matter of driving around looking at
signs.
Signs, I see Dunleavy signs around
yeah,
there.
I
haven't seen any
too.
Baggage signs.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen a few Walker signs.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think there's one other person in the Republican.
Treadwell.
Treadwell.
Right.
Again, I haven't seen as much because he was a
Scott Hawkins.
More recent. And Scott
mm-hmm.
Hawkins.
Yeah.
So it would appear, some would suggest, that the battle in the Republican primary will be between Meet Treadwell and Dunleavy.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see how that goes, whether Treadwell's kind of late entry,
mm-hmm.
last-minute entry.
But well-known in this.
Yep.
I mean, he used to
yep.
be lieutenant governor, so he's not starting from zero.
Yeah, yeah. So those will play out, and we'll see how that goes.
It's going to be a very intense season. It is all over the country. We're watching some primary results, you know, roll out now. So we're not the only ones, but we're going to be very focused. And Alaskans don't really pay much attention to it during the summer, Mike. You know, they're out fishing and doing and going to, there's lots of events going on. And the better the sun is, the least, you know, they can't care about politics. But as things start to, school starts, they start thinking about going back to school and the weather starts changing, they're going to start paying attention.
So you mentioned fishing, and of course the big news has to do with Chitna.
Mm.
First time in 50 years, I understand, the Chitna dipnet subsistence fishery is closed.
Mm. Unbelievable.
With a very, very bad beginning to the commercial sockeye season at the mouth of the Copper River this year, an intention to have escapements so that there will be runs in the future. People have to understand that if they don't get up there, they don't do what they do to come back in following years.
That's right.
So closed fishery. It's time to look at possibilities of getting there. Might be September. There are 100, typically in a year, I'm understanding, 170,000 fish that are taken there. So you think about all of the families that, and I've done it many years, who go up there and limit.
Dip net, limit out.
Mm-hmm. You know, 30 fish or whatever. It's a huge thing.
Mm-hmm.
That is a dramatic piece of change And one reference that I saw in an article suggested that a filet had reached $35 a pound down in a market in Seattle.
Oh, I saw it for more than that even.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. That's what it was here. I think they were getting upwards to 75. It's dropping quick because they can't get the fish. So what we'll see, and maybe that's the price adjustment. I don't know. There's a lot of reasons for it, Mike. No, a lot of finger pointing going on. You know, it's sort of my mind anyway, just my personal opinion, sort of the perfect storm of an increasing warm ocean that is making the fish go deeper, not return. There's the constant battle between commercial fishermen and sports fishermen, and I think there is some onus on how exactly we're doing fish counting and how good that science is. And is it better in some areas than other areas? And do we need to readdress what the resources are given to do that?
Or is it a function of the blob, that very large
warm? I saw that, But, you know, is that, to me, that's sort of a saying, well, this is a one-time occurrence. It's going to happen. It's not going to happen again. I think it's a bit bigger thing than that. But, you know, there's a lot of different philosophies. But, you know, I was thinking yesterday, driving back from Anchorage, just how resources go like that. You know, the timber industry, you know, how clear cutting was such a, you know, decimated communities because every tree got taken. And then we slowly unwound out of that and started being more selective. And the science got better about, you know, reseeding and that sort of thing. So this is not the first go around with a resource that needs to, I just hope, doesn't get decimated, since so many Alaskans and tourists. I mean, how that'll impact the tourist season and how people, you know, friends and family come up during a season because they want the thrill of being there while you do that and eating the fresh fish. I was in Costco yesterday. There was really very little fresh fish there. Yep. Didn't go to Sagaya's, but they're going to start feeling it. These markets are going to start feeling it. And Alaskans are very used to having their fresh fish. I'm one of them.
Let us shift a little bit to the governor's actions, because even though the legislative session ended a while ago, the final signing off and the opportunity to veto has come and gone. And the governor has struck through a line item, a small amount, but to some people it was a very significant thing. Both the fact that it was included in the budget and the fact that he cut it out, and I'm talking about $2.5 million that had been assigned to put the Knik Arm Bridge on life support, gone. What's your opinion there?
Yeah, you know, there'll be no shortage of opinions on that. There's certainly the $2.8 million or whatever it was, wasn't really going to move the rock any farther. It was basically just going to sit there and give people hope. You know, this is hard fiscal times, and I think that the governor probably looked at it and said there's a lot more needed that can be, you know, that money can be applied elsewhere. He's been pretty supportive of a commuter rail service. Maybe they'll find the money to eke out to do a better study on that and see how that might alleviate some of the traffic. Was there some politics involved? You betcha. There's always politics involved. But, you know, there really wasn't much to veto in the budget that he was given. So that made sense. You also, another thing that was vetoed, Mike, was the vitamin D study that was a lot talked about, the $500,000 that Paul Seaton wanted for a vitamin D study that he thought would pay off in benefits for healthcare costs decreases. So it wasn't the only thing that was taken away. The Juneau Road did stay in there. You know, maybe that's the voice of Alaskans saying we want better access to our capital, and the governor is supportive of keeping the capital where it is for now. Hard to say. There's always political motivations, and then there's really the way the state is just kind of sort of on life support of itself for funding, that there's just logical ones that you have to do so that you can continue to fund smaller projects in your communities and infrastructure that you really need.
And it's, I think, instructive to note that at least one bond rating agency, because of the actions taken by the legislature, in particular with the use of the permanent fund monies, raised the rating to, I think, stable.
Mm-hmm. Because at least there's a little plan now, right?
Yeah, something like that. The other thing that was interesting and has received considerable discussion has to do with a buffer zone around Denali. that was suggested to be put in place to protect the wolves that drift out of the park into nearby areas. It was something that the governor had, if one looks back a few years, had seemed to be in support of doing. And then this was one of those cases where there was not a finalization of making that happen. Apparently, there were some of the landowners nearby who complained. But I know that Mr. Steiner, who has been often a proponent of doing a more, what he would term, a rational plan for wolves in the Denali area, heavily criticized the governor for that. Not much response yet that I have seen. So a lot of things that were either done or not done will affect our lives here in the valley.
Yeah, and you'll have a whole new group of some new, some old legislators next year. So it always makes things get off to a very slow start as the freshmen kind of get in gear, as new staff comes on. Staff shifted oftentimes, longtime staffers change their guy or girl goes away, and they have to find a new job. And of course, we've heard, you know, some resignations that are pretty substantial. Representative Lescaro, who's been there for 15, 18 years, I don't know what, well respected in the House, is taking a break, as he says, and helping someone from his district take his seat while he goes off and does other things. It kind of sounds like what Hollis French did a few years ago, and they're good friends. But so it's going to be very interesting to see. Will they have a bipartisan coalition? Did that really serve a good purpose last year? I think I've seen some polling, state polling, that suggests that people, one issue that's very high on their minds is they want their legislature to get along. They want them to have a bipartisan effort. It's a very, people are a little fed up with the back and forth of the, it's fair to say a lot fed up with the back and forth political hijinks. There, things are like the smoke-free workplace bill that I'm glad that passed, but still sore that it took 5 years to pass. They want to see the legislature putting things that are heavily supported through and not playing games with that kind of stuff and using resources for those type of things, like special sessions when they don't do anything. So I think the public has been sounded pretty loud about that.
So we're nearly done with this edition of Valley Edition, and probably should at least bow in the direction of the weather. We've noted that the rivers have risen, but it doesn't appear that they've gone to an extraordinary form of flooding. They seem to be peaking at the moment. We also note that there were 6 to 8 inches up at Eureka, Glen Highway.
Snow.
The pictures were very revealing. Of course, we expect snow to happen in the mountains, but that's a high highway, but still in all, it reminds you of things.
Yeah, and you know, we're not out of the woods yet because we're expecting now a few days of rain, and that snow has to melt somewhere in those mountains. So for now, the mat's okay, but it's going to be something they're going to be keeping a close eye on.
Okay, well, I want to thank you, Terry Snyder, for coming in today for another edition of Valley Edition, and we'll be back next week. So whether it rains, it snows, or the sun shines, have a good week.
You've been listening to Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Matsu Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky. Valley Edition is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of hosts or guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, this station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions about this program, email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.